We're going to go ahead and get started. I got the idea of having the three of us read together when I was considering some of the work that we were all doing regarding a variety of identities that we've been exploring in each of our writing. So we've set this up as kind of an essay sandwich because we're going to have Karen Anderson England read her essay in the middle while Susan Elizabeth Howe reads her poetry first, and I will finish with my poetry. So I'll introduce each of them now, and then we'll start with the reading. Karen Anderson England is a doctoral student at the University of Utah, and she's studying creative writing, and in particular, the nonfiction, creative nonfiction genre. She teaches at Utah Valley State College. She is an assistant professor there. And Susan Elizabeth Howe is the author of a book, poetry book, Stone Spirits, and she currently lives in Ephraim. We will start with hearing from Susan Elizabeth Howe. And I am Danielle Beezer-Dubrasky, and I am also a doctoral student at the University of Utah. I'm studying poetry writing and in their creative writing program, and I am a lecturer at Southern Utah University down in Cedar City, Utah.
It's a pleasure to be here, especially to see so many friends that I haven't seen forever, and thank you very much for coming in. Also, it's a pleasure to read with Danielle and Karen, whom I admire intensely, both of them. What has been interesting to us is the way voices weave together, the way there are aspects of yourself that come out in your poetry that seem so very different in different poems. And so that's what our poems will be about, or they will be many different voices. Most of my poems are not in my own voice, although a couple are. But I'm not confessing which. The first poem is called Maisie, and the only thing I want to tell you is that maize, as you know, is also corn, and it's really about corn. It's about corn sex. Maisie, gypsy, show off, your taffeta leaves sweep the wind, whip as you sway in the dance of the field. Lure of the male, his sex while you wrestle and stay still. The idea of union in your head like those golden tassels. Teach me your tricks, showgirl, the shimmy of cool days, bright breezes. When you call out that potent dust, brush it into the sweet place of your heat. I want to be like you, layers of husk and silky hair showing. When will you give up your beads of pure yellow, smooth and bumpy? Contradiction, like all sex, is contradiction. This poem is written about BYU, and it's for Scott Abbott. It's what administrators wish they could tell you. From where we sit, you should be quiet. We consider our staff as essential as hot air balloons at the circus. If one pops, the sword swallowers, acrobats, cheetahs won't know how to go on. Too many will wind up in that blind corridor, lights diminishing in both directions, no one knowing the way to the toilets. Of course we lie, or talk in abstractions that have to be split like a melon, the juices stuck in the flesh and needing to be sucked out. We often send you to stand in the wrong line, so you will never get into the executive lounge, your green skin, your stomach cramps, wondering where someone hid the key. But don't explode, or your face will stick in the windshield in the unexpected crash, and you'll sit there holding the bloodied stump of a pinky. If someone tells the truth, you might have to sue. And how effective will it be to rub your hands, especially that damaged one, against the stone face of a building? No, it hasn't. This is a poem. You know how there's an image of the Virgin Mary in a tree in Salt Lake City? Well, this is an interview of a KUTV reporter with the Virgin Mary, and it's called KUTV Interviews the Virgin Mary, who has come to Salt Lake City. Why appear in the trunk of a tree? Isn't your radiance dulled by wood? I accustom myself to slivers under my fingernails, peeling back from my forehead. There are similar rigors in other venues. The tortilla spreads corn dust through my lungs. My flesh dissolves at the bottom of a well. My skin blisters in mirrored glass. To rephrase my question, why do you consent to this tacky sideshow? Cheap candles, plastic flowers, the Naugahyde-covered prayer rail, old carpets pieced together around the tree. Young man, climb the platform. Stare into my misplaced eyes, one above, one below. If you have spiritual sense or spiritual imagination, you can discern my aureole. Try the touch of my tears as they drip down the whole of my being into the tuna fish tin nailed at my feet. I don't disbelieve, but why slum? 8 blocks from here, they'd receive you with ceremony. Why not appear in the cathedral? A simple sunflower, beautiful in itself, by many is turned into a weed. What woman can speak her mind without consequences to other women in the church? Well, what do you hope to accomplish through your manifestation? So many come for compassion, their suffering fibrous and dense. I help them cut out these growths. So yours is a traditional healing mission? What should I hope for the stupid, brutal man who last week in this park stabbed a child 30 times in the throat, raped her, stuffed her panties into her mouth? Torture, if you can arrange it, at least a televised trial, conviction, the worst of all executions, then eternal damnation in hell. But if I return him to the womb, the effects of amniotic fluid on the deformed soul, I am speaking of literal birth. If I suckle him, won't my milk restore his innocence and infant's sweet-smelling flesh? Has anyone been born twice? I'm skeptical, but if you succeed, contact me exclusively. Don't mock me, media child. You can't conceive of my sorrow. I have worked 2,000 years to learn how I am favored, blessed. Don't underestimate a mother's tears or the aftermath. Poem is in the voice of a sphinx at the Belvedere Palace in Austria, outside Vienna. There's a whole garden with sphinx figures placed throughout the garden, and this is just the story of one of them. My eyes cast down, I am so demure, posed on my haunches, desirable, with a young, kissable face and half-smile and rings threaded through elaborate hair. Each luxuriant braid falling across my shoulder just happens to rest centimeters from a delicious nipple. You notice my breasts, twin worlds, uncovered below the tasseled halter. So many men have reached to touch the medallion, their fingers tracing my throat, feigning interest in me and my own personal emblem, the Filvice flowers. I will give you the loveliest view of Vienna, the spire of St. Stephen's tiles, the Habsburg Palace, the whole city of Freud. But if you don't answer my riddle, you must forfeit your life. Why do you imagine a woman with claws and wings and feline genitals? This next poem, like I started it thinking I wasn't writing it in my own voice, but I have road rage, and I'm afraid that it is my own voice, though it's supposed to be someone else's voice. It's called Sport Utility Luxury. The colors, the brochure tells me, are champagne, platinum, and subtle gold. Nothing subtle about gold. One look at the price, and sure I can buy this car if they'll take aspen leaves for money. Now I see them all over the city, backcountry outfits for city dogs, by Lexus, Mercedes, Cadillac. Tough cars for surgeons who cut across mountains to work on your liver or your heart. Bank executives driving right up the pile, rebounding NBA stars, pushy as cop cars. Center and Holiday Boulevard, the light changes, and this big roller with a phone for an ear takes off like the Home Shopping Network, guns his engine, which is butter and silk, cuts into my lane with 6 inches to spare between his taillight and the wink of my one-eyed 85 truck. Then the bastard slows to turn right. I could have smashed him from behind, but I braked and went with a curse. You mollusk with a metal shell and no backbone. Someday soon may you four-wheel yourself backwards off a cliff and into a five-time rollover. When you smash in the canyon, may your insurance fail and all your passengers sue for punctured lungs and severely broken bones. The guy is red taillights, eyes of a snake. He thinks my curse slid off his waxed onyx shine, but he'd better watch his paint. Words spit acid, in time acid corrodes. And I have another poem that's in the voice of Giraffes. I just can't find it. I can't find the Giraffes poem, but I have another poem that's about, it comes from living in Ephraim, where I've now moved, and it's about the deer and what happens to the deer. It's called We Sense the Deer. We sense the deer when we walk through alfalfa fields, pastures, foothills near home. Though vague, they are sometimes manifest, like our naive notions of goodness. It is better to put an injured deer out of its misery, is one such notion, which this doe our dog has run down seems to affirm, her back leg dangling in three directions like a broken broomstick, wood cracked, but fibers hinging the pieces. That leg twists like the turn we're all approaching, the automobile wreck, the fall on the ice, when the graceful body fractures into parts we drag, with less and less strength toward the end of life. Once it happens, our defenses are as pathetic as this doe's, which paws at the space the dog might cross on the way to her throat. We haul off our golden lab, see the deer sink in pain in plain view, except that she is the color of winter mud she lies in. Muscle spasms show us what it took for her to run from the dog. Our task settles on us like the weight of the shadowless dark. Call a neighbor because actually we don't own a gun. But when my husband goes back with death in his hands, the doe is already gone on her three good legs, a truth I will never track down. For weeks I think of her resting all day in the cedars, moving at night. The leg may rot till it poisons her. Or grown stiff, it may tangle in barbed wire and trap her inside fences she once could cross. I've seen dead deer, their reduction to putrid piles, but never this excruciating passage toward the body's loss. Out there in the brush, she rests or staggers, suffering I can't limit to one animal, though it is the doe's struggle across the landscape of the mortal I focus on now. And the last poem is written in response to a question a friend of mine from Florida asked me, that is, Will You Leave Utah?, which is the title. Will You Leave Utah? And it's in numbered sections, and it has an epigraph. The epigraph is, How do you spell Utah? Playboys Miss July to Utah basketball coach Rick Majerus. He actually said that. Somebody asked him, a Playboy Miss something asked him how to spell Utah. One. The Great Salt Lake is all that's left of a primitive inland sea. If you think of us 30,000 years ago, we're buried by tons of water. We move slower. When we think, pressure stalls us. Two. Mormon pioneers walked so far to get here, the horizon curved away behind them, eclipsing the past. Three. Mostly poor, they dragged their faith in their wagons, believing God spoke to a backwoods kid with a question and no education, and why not any of us? Four. Because I work at this conservative religious educational place, if I were to use hegemony and Mormon and patriarchy in print in the same sentence, I might be fired. So I'd never do that. Five. Once rattlesnakes spit out most of our region's poison. Even though I've lived here most of my life, I've only seen a dead one, limp as a drained hose, its head cut off by teenage boys, the same ones who drive their pickups at night into the West Desert, floodlight the sage, and blast jackrabbits. 6. Among other things, I believe in quilts, pioneer quilts, art in cotton, patterns from scraps. 7. Atop Zion's West Rim Trail, my sight crosses chasm after chasm, plateau after plateau, to a blue rim of mountains 100 miles away. Space for my thoughts. 8. At Bingham is Kennicott's open pit mine. When I was a child, a terraced mountain in the Ochres fed the company low-grade ore. Now, in the same place, a terraced crater the size of a meteor coils into the earth. 9. My father grows 11 colors of iris, row after row next to beans and summer squash. The blossoms, even black, even golden tan, too delicate for the desert. 10. Beyond the Salt Lake Valley, on the other side of the Ochres, the army incinerates shells of nerve gas, first crushing the casings. Sometimes instruments detect leaks that might blow over Tooele or Grantsville. 11. Tooele is pronounced Tooele. 12. The snow in the highest mountains is dry and light as cosmic dust we rose from and will, one winter night, shiver back into. 13. The eyes of our state legislators bead in on vice. Like seagulls after crickets, they swoop down on gambling in Utah's Wendover and drinking in limousines. But last year they flew up, defended their constitutional rights, made it legal to carry concealed handguns in public places, for instance, parks. Although, they added, you probably won't need them at church. 14. The first settlers in Sand Peak camped by a cliff pocked with rattlesnake caves. They were directed by prophecy to build a temple on the very spot. 15. You'd swear the light on sandstone arches and towers comes from inside. This is a place the Anasazi had visions, carved them into the rock. 16. A 1,000-foot drop straight off your path to a silver ribbon of river and thick green cottonwoods. 17. The salt flats laid themselves down over eons of the lake's rise and fall. Once glass-hard paths of land rockets, now the flats rut and slush, leaching. Out there a potash plant stews and a magnesium plant spews cumulonimbus chlorine gas. 18. Goshute Indians have had the latest vision, government contracts. The Great Spirit wants them to store nuclear waste on the reservation and medicine dance themselves into Arizona. 19. Should I follow? Or as the man asked who got off the plane with me in Salt Lake City one summer dawn, the sun just tipping the mountains over canyons cool as a kiss, why would anyone want to live anywhere else? Thank you.
Kind of intimidating to read with poets. This is called Post. The dental technician grinds gritty pink crap over my kid's baby teeth. Owner of baby teeth wreathes and closes his eyes, chokes back a panic, and I say, "You're brave, Porter. You're so brave." Technician tells me, "We don't say brave, because then children come to think they're having an unpleasant experience." I say, "You're so courageous, Porter." And she says, "No, that means the same thing." I say, "Yes, of course, how unpleasant." And she puts the whizzy thing down to glare. Porter takes in a half breath. Glinty, technician dips and revs. Glazed, after, Porter sits mid-seat in the minivan beside his sister. We enter Albertson's, and a woman vaguely familiar says, "Hello." I look behind me, but she is addressing us. "Hello, Porter," she beams. "Hello, Maya. Now, what was your name?" I gape, incapable, and she says, "Oh, I'm the nursery leader at church. We don't see you much, do we?" But then we just moved in, Allegheny Way. I'm thinking, this is freaking Utah. Do subdivisions in Pennsylvania name their streets Wasatch, Rocky, Uinta, Ochre, Buena Vista? Fascinating. Andelin, I say. Helen, Andelin. I thought it was the name of a country. Ireland? Yes, Patricia. No, England. Sister England. My husband says your husband makes such interesting comments in Sunday school. Oh, I say, but don't inquire further. We gaze toward the potato chips. Treat, asks Maya, and I tell her maybe. Be good. A parental admonition I despise, particularly when directed to tiny girls who are good. She picks lifesavers and shares them with Porter, whose teeth were clean. Next morning, my oldest child doesn't want to go to school. We have a substitute, she explains. Well, what kind of reason is that, I ask. She's weird, Amelia says, and I say, whoa. If weirdness is going to get in the way of your education, you'd better not be thinking of grad school. And she says, Mom, please, I'm only 9. What's weird about the substitute, I inquire. She hates to read, Amelia says. We were right in the middle of this book about African-American kids marching to Birmingham, and she just stopped in the middle of the sentence and started staring at it. So we asked the substitute, what's the matter? Don't you like the story? And she said, absolutely not. So we had to stop and do times tables. Besides, she's not a citizen of this country. How do you know that? I ask. Because she didn't put her hand on her heart, and Jason asked why not, and she told us, I'm not a citizen of this country, but her husband is a military man, and she's been a visitor of many countries. That's what she told us then. What the hell? I say, and my husband asks our daughter, how long will this substitute be substituting? Till Friday. But she's still a good teacher. She knows a lot about science. I like science. I know, just don't learn that baby talk voice. Mom, please. Mark and I still mainly address each other through our children since purchasing the minivan 2 weeks ago. We both like it, except the color. But I wanted to set the record straight on who did the choosing. Not that it was a bad choice, but we were pretty patriarchal about it, weren't we? He says, he said yes on the bucket seat, didn't he? To which I reply, that's just the damn point, isn't it? What do you mean? You said yes. What do you think you are, my father or something? And he says, I wanted the bench seat in the middle, but you wanted the buckets and you got them, didn't you? I say, that's not the point. Can't you see? That's not the point. Since there is yet no consensus on the point, he takes the kids to school in the minivan, and I drive the Jeep to work and teach my students how to organize a composition for maximum communicational impact. A tall girl grabs my sleeve on my way back to my office, waves a piece of paper in my face, and says, help me, I have to go out this door, I have to catch the number 15 bus. You help me. She's wearing a fatly inflated parka and a hat with a brim and woolly flaps. I'm not wearing much, considering the gale, but she has my sleeve. She looks 18 or so, somebody's odd daughter or sister. Do you know where the bus stop is? I ask. No, no, I want you to help me, she says, annoyed that I'm stupid. And I finally get it, and we walk out the funny side door, down the untraveled alley to the familiar front of the building, but she holds my sleeve, and I trek out to the stop with her. We wait 10 minutes for the 15 bus, and I say, here it is, good luck, show the driver your transfer instructions, but she's already on it, and I sort of miss her. I wave, but she's on the other side, looking out the window at the flurries. I walk back in, very cold, revisiting Mark's account of his recent conversation with the bishop, who asked him exactly what was it he said about drinking alcoholic beverages to the 14-year-olds when he was the substitute teacher last Sunday. Maybe because it just occurred to me I'd like to sip a margarita on a warm beach rather than hike the stairs to my office, but probably because I'm still feeling quarrelsome about the minivan. Mark said all he told them that was that whatever they do, don't drive drunk and don't go getting pregnant or getting someone pregnant, not until you finish college at least. That's all. And he can't see why they all went home saying Brother England told them it might not be so bad if they slipped up once in a while, so long as. Mark, the walking charm chain of diverse significations, the catch-and-carry declaration that, no, we're not all like that, see? One man demonstration that 6 generations of gold plates and singularity did not culminate in a plank walk. The straight, so straight, curly-haired boy with a ponytail and apostate wife, a guy who'd forgive a 14-year-old for slipping up. Just can't figure out why the congregation doesn't understand. Just wants to help them see the Buena Vista. What did you tell the bishop? I said, sorry. I didn't mean that. I only meant this. How is it you can't predict after so many misunderstandings, I accuse him. Is it that you can't or that you won't? And then personally, I can't quite think why he ought to, since he's the only one of them I'd ever marry or stay married to, although we nearly lost it over the minivan, which is probably actually about religion or sex or society. I don't see them for so long, so damn forever long on Tuesdays. I drive the length of the Wasatch on Tuesdays, teach in the morning, and get taught at night. Tonight, a small book on meltdowns. A small story of contamination and a brain operation. German to boot. So ponderous, Wendy says. I felt so sarcastic after I read it, Samantha says. And I wish I could be so postmodern, because I felt so compelled to run up the stairs and check on the kids. So compelled. I almost get there, almost get so postmodern, but then I have to run upstairs and touch their narrow chests, feel their small, stinky breath on my cheek when I read Meltdown, because I haven't had time yet to make myself very clear. Couldn't stop hating him over a minivan quick enough, maybe. Couldn't counter the substitute. Didn't get their baby teeth clean enough. Mom, next time you argue with Dad, Porter says, don't throw a chair, okay? I tell him, I'll try not to, but I might. We can't know the future. At least we didn't break anything, did we? Count your blessings. Name them. One by blue fingernails. A guy by me on UTA says, what does that mean? It means I'm a parent, I say. Answer. A parent, he asks. A permanent Sharpie. Won't wash off for a day or so. I was buying time, letting my little girl paint them while I talked to a friend on the phone. She colored my toenails, too. Bought me another couple of minutes. One by one.
This set of poems are poems I'd like to be seen as a kind of a composition that look at different identities and maybe even a different identities in one person. The first poem is called Arachne, and that's based on the myth about Arachne, who challenged the goddess Athena, I believe, that she could weave better than Athena, and she won the challenge, and Athena turned her into a spider. So that was what happened to her. Arachne. She weaves all night the memory of girls at the university dive, where frat boys eye their high scene of sundresses, bare legs, sandals, where their tossed hair says, what else to do in this town after winning the game? She weaves their hearts through indigo, vermilion, piecing a stained glass shimmer. Pierced by divine stare, she shrinks, into her body's new silk, weaves shatters fine as hair, undone on Sunday morning, a long thread of weeping. This next poem is one that really does, I was experimenting with these different identities, and it's in parts, and each part has a title that precedes it. And the parts vary in length, and they also vary in pronoun. And perhaps just as an explanation, there's the idea is that there's a soul who's referred to as she, and then there is the person in the poem who is I. And it's titled A Girl in America. Broken and the Past. Somewhere between Utah and Virginia, my soul ditches my body at the rest stop where my father slices half moons of watermelon, hands one to me, my mother rinsing out bottles, my brother lost in his crying. Its coldness chimes in my mouth. Turquoise and silver in the cold water. My father's body sealed in a black coffin. The stream where I lost my bracelet. My soul slips into a hand span of dream. Space enough for a starfish. Red pulse against rock. Unswallowed, her scream echoes in the worldless bones of my wrist. Nocturne. Foam at her ankles, white beneath the moon. Family gone, house and trees gone. Her hair and the crook of her knee. Looked out, you disappeared while watching a girl across the lawn stretch her leg long against her face. Your face rises in the peonies where red ants forage the petals. Shaken loose, they fall into the fountain, become boat lights shimmering on the water. I slip my hand in to part the lights, but they close over my wrist. The porch light stays lit until fireflies flash above the grass. Awakening. Something is being uncovered, something undone, a rendezvous or buttons. Sea at twilight empties into the sky. So good to breathe. Stars and conifers waiting all along. Vignette. My soul amidst wet oak bark, quiet in her walking, alone in her waking. I smell the trees in a restaurant full of strangers. I open my hand to count change. That's how quickly the door shuts behind me. And I see her paleness in moths veiling a streetlight. I thirst for the smell of trees. The Atlantic. She has its gray eye. This next poem is called Hollow of Linoleum. I lived down in southern Utah in Cedar City, and I have a neighbor who through diabetes, she was having a hard time remembering things. And she's mentioned a couple of times in this poem, once in this poem, and then once in a final poem, the last poem I'll read. Hollow of Linoleum. She laughs through a summer of moths beating against the screen, the porch light. Opens the window, lets in a tiger moth, holds it in a jar as it breathes through the punctured lid. In the morning, she slides its brittle body onto the grass. Within her brick house on the cul-de-sac, she lives in a glass globe shaken with snowflakes where no one speaks to her or to each other, and they all grow up and die young in some ways while still in there rearranging their smiles. Her body becomes pale as paper, face and arms letting in light as she stands in doorways, startled by long division, shadows and pigeons, spiders that move like quick shadows in corners. The daylight over a hollow of linoleum seeks something beyond antenna-capped houses, something finer, grander than white contrails and laundry drying on the line beside a hedge of wild roses. Meals on Wheels stops at her neighbor's house, where the woman sits in a chair waiting for visitors. The last time she visited, her neighbor, still walking, opened the china cabinet, pulled out two red maracas, shook them above her head, the wild sand a whisper of joy. This poem is called My Other Sister. My father sends letters from Cambodia and later photos of a world that looks purple with rice paddies and dark-haired daughters, a girl who could have been my sister, 7 or 8, emerging on a street corner, long enough for my father to consider bringing her home before she's lost in the crowd's crush. I almost brought her home, my father says, to a brittle house bricked in from the war, serving Swanson's for dinner. What would we have done, my new sister and me? Played Barbies in G.I. Joes with my brothers, planted small plastic army men throughout the periwinkle under the peony bush. My father collects his pens before a long business trip, arranges them in rows and briefcase, smooth casings of heavy black ink. Then we see him off at the airport. My mother drives us home, and I imagine my ghost of a sister watching with new eyes the green landscape of trees, the brown landscape of strip malls. The house quiet, no stir from a purple country, just unwashed dishes sticky with syrup, my brothers and me in the basement watching beach blanket bingo, unswept leaves and dead potato bugs webbed to the screen door, a summer of uncertain peace my other sister never knew. And this final poem is called Five Windows. Small things undo me. The dishwasher cycles, the clocks tick, the ceiling fans hum. 4 in the morning, the clock stops. I've dusted and swept the room, lifted each knick-knack, the glass heart from our wedding, crested with peach-colored kissing birds. I've overlooked a gray sheen on the coffee table. Gray-blue morning filters through the blinds, an insular morning of white paneled walls, silent dark wood chairs and table. A gray cat minces down the stairs. Breezes flow through the screen of apples fallen beneath the neighbor's tree. Leaf shadows sway in piecemeal moonlight. I haven't thought about my father for a long time. I see him in the honey locust dead branch amidst the others full of leaves. Is that his life after this one? We all disappear and reappear in some form. I pass myself in the roses along the walkway, the wisteria vine wrapped around the porch. I see my father in the air between the dark branches that strike the summer sky with winter. Someone tamped American flags into the grass last night. In one star, I see the lights of Circus Circus. In another, the Waldrug billboard. In yet another, the Salt Lake Temple glistens. The nation itself hangs in a plastic furl, limp and shimmery as the July air, torn to pieces by a cat's cry. What answers this morning? The two-foot-high maple inquires of the air with its leaves. Wild roses drop their petals from their rose hips. Others in town are waking or have been awake a long time. Our neighbor watches our house through her doorway. She doesn't remember her children's names, doesn't remember growing up in this house that her grandfather built 90 years ago. Mornings pass through her mind from this house or her own, mornings of budded roses pocketing their blushes. These rooms remember her, a girl waking early for the parade. She opens a window to let in the sky. Thank you all so much for coming to our reading.